This is the podcast for Wednesday, February 1st, 2012, Theories of Knowledge. Let's see, don't forget to post the forum before Sunday, 11:55 p.m. On the forum post, just a couple of reminders. If you're going to put thought into your post, which you should, then it's going to take you a little time to type it. Type it in a word processor, save as plain text, and then paste it. I'm seeing a few people, most people are pretty good. I see people with like garbage characters in some of their posts. I have to go in there and correct it. I see people with like giant jumbo fonts, and I see people with like little tiny fonts that I can't read. So if you just like save as plain text, and just paste in, or use the paste special or paste and match style, it should all work out fine. And
is there anything wrong with just doing it in the...
You can do it that way if you want to risk a connection error. What I do is I like type stuff in that little window there, and then I like copy it before I press the send button, because I got my laptop, so I'm not going to have a power failure. If my hard drive goes kablooey, I'll have bigger problems than a power failure or what I spent 5 minutes typing. So, although I'm pretty good about backing that up, too, as you should be. Yeah.
On that posting, you already know who we are, right? When we posted
yeah.
it without using our name.
Right. And you should see every other student there. You see the picture and you see their name right in each post. So don't put your name in there, because that's just redundant. What else? Don't make your posts too long. Don't make them too short. So, between 100 and 300 words, or 102 words, there's 40 students in each section. That's a lot of reading for me and for you. And you're supposed to watch all the posts. And, again, anything in the forums is fair game for exams. Yeah.
You probably already covered this, but just a quick question. If, for example, on Sunday, we missed the midnight or the 1 o'clock deadline, rather. For example, if we put it in like a day or two late,
right.
Do we have one grace?
So the week 10 form, there's an extra credit form that'll be there,
gotcha.
And you'll be able to post that.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
So you get one do over. The other ones,
is it a reduced point amount? Or?
I was just Zeppo.
Gotcha.
Zero.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So you get one miss. If you have something where you're like, you get students who are like in the hospital, they bring their doctor's note, they have something really serious happen. But if your car broke down and you're in drain and you get back to civilization where there was a wireless network or whatever, that's one of your do-overs, right? That's what the week 10 form is for.
And
so.
You only have to post for one topic, right?
Right.
Okay, cool.
One post per week to any topic. And the topics are just a suggestion, so, usually they'll say something like, you post something on Barkley, and you'll have like three or four things that I mentioned, and they say, or post something, completely different on Barkley. Just it has to be on Barkley. I have no idea why that door is locked. It's not supposed to be at this hour. They have all these automatic locks now. What's going on with that? So just one post per week, any topic. Jamila Kareem is going to be here tomorrow at 1 o'clock and then also at 4 o'clock. So I think it's 1 to 2:30 and then 4 to 5:30. The 4 to 5:30 is in the Center for Media and Learning. I'm not sure where the 1 to 2:30 is. I have a link on the social forum that should have a link to that information. The 1 o'clock talk will be on the Nation of Islam, which is an interesting Americanized form of Islam that mixes Islam with Black Baptist tradition in America, plus some kind of interesting mythology about UFOs. So she'll be talking about, in connection with the Nation of Islam, issues of race, class, and gender. And so if you're interested in that, or what the deals with Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam, come on down. So it's tomorrow at 1 o'clock, and then at 4 o'clock it's in the Center for Media and Learning. And I'll post another reminder note there on the social forum that gives the meeting rooms and times. I think I've got one up there already for the 4 o'clock, but I just found out about the that somebody would remind me of the 1 o'clock one. And there's posters around campus here too, and I'll see if I can give a link to the poster as well. It should have all the info on there.
The 4 o'clock covering the same subject.
The 4 o'clock is on it's on issues of race and gender in Islam. And so that's more about Islam proper, I believe. Whereas the 1 o'clock is about the Nation of Islam, which is this kind of heretical offshoot that exists in America. I should have called the poster here. I don't have it at my fingertips. But I'll send it on out to the social forum. Okay. What's the other things? Let's talk more about Barclay. So last time we were talking about what would Barclay say about this idea that, okay, you need substance to support qualities because something has to support them. And then someone raised an objection, well, what about the earth? The earth isn't supported by anything, so what would he say about that? I think Barclay might say that that's really Locke's problem, and that Locke has this notion of support. Of course, Barclay, where it's all ideas, this idea of support, he's just sort of using Locke's language and says, okay, you're saying that substance has to support qualities, okay? All right, well, what does that mean? And then he shows it leads to an absurdity. But Barclay isn't committed to this absurdity. He's not even committed to this notion of support or that everything requires a support. That's Locke's assumption. And Barclay's just showing that the assumption when applied to qualities and substance leads to an absurdity or an infinite regress. So I think that's what he'd say about that argument.
So he's just playing on Locke's words, essentially?
Well, he's playing on Locke's premises. He says, okay, you Locke, you say qualities can't just exist sort of floating out there in the ether as bare ideas. They have to be like in something. So this is the whole idea of an object. And Locke even, you know, through Hylas' spokesperson in the dialogue is represented of saying, okay, well, there's two things. There is the qualities, which are the sense data, the purpleness, the cylindricity, the size, the shape, the color, all those things form the object. Or all those things are part of the object. But then there's the object itself, which has those qualities. So you got a thing and its properties. You have the object and its qualities. All right, these are all different ways of saying the same thing. You have the, so here's Locke's idea. External object, material object, thing. Etc. These are all described by nouns. Oops. Yeah, the cup. The cat. The car, or whatever. And then you have properties or qualities. Things like purple, cylindrical, fuzzy, the description for a car, broken, broken, rusty or whatever. Rusty, there you go. Fast. So, fast, right? So all these are different ways in which these objects exist. And these are described by adjectives. They describe ways in which the thing exists. Now, what Barclay wants to say is that a thing is just a collection of properties. So in other words, what is a cup? A cup is just the collection of qualities with the sense properties of the cup. Locke wants to say that you have the real object. And then there's sort of the sense data or ideas. was represent
the object
and its properties
or qualities. I keep on switching back and forth.
Properties and qualities mean the same thing. So you have simple ideas represent, and actually, simple ideas represent qualities, and the complex ideas represent the object. And these are mental,
internal.
These are in your mind.
And you're saying that there is a real object, correct?
Yeah, Locke is saying that. External.
Right.
You have the external object that's out there in the world, and then you have your internal mental representation of the object. Okay, so we're talking about Locke here. Real objects in the material world. And there's these two worlds. There's the external world of matter, and then there's the internal world of mental representation. Getting kind of messy here. Matter and mental representation. But mental representation. So these things in your mind represent the real world out there, your consciousness. Now, Berkeley comes along, and what's his take on this?
There is no real object. It's just mental representations by God. Is that right?
Well, if there's representations, what are they representing?
That there's mental ideas that come down from God, is that?
Yeah, so they're not really representations because they don't represent anything.
They're just ideas.
They're just ideas, right. Now, would Berkeley say that he denies the existence of real things? He does? Does he say that? He's accused of that so Philonous, standing for Berkeley, is accused of denying the existence of real things. So, Ilus says, Philonous, you deny the existence of real things. What's Polonius's response? Again, representing Berkeley. No, I'm not. I'm just giving them their proper definition. I'm just giving them their proper definition, which is, what is a real thing? Well, real things are collections of sense properties or sense data. Or in Locke's terminology, what would he call a collection of sense data? Or a collection of simple ideas? Complex idea, right? So in other words, Locke says you have this complex idea of the chair that represents the real chair out there in the world. Berkeley says, no, the real chair is the idea, the complex idea in your mind. There is no other chair. And this is what, when you have this like long description and discussion of what are sensible things. And Hylas says, well, of course, sensible things are those things which are sensed. Okay, well, Barclay says, you know, through, again, Polonus, representing Barclay, says, well, what do you sense? And he, oh, you know, sounds, right? And tastes and smells and visual sensations, right? And they both agree on that. And then he says, well, is it direct or indirect? In other words, when you're perceiving, when you're using your senses, is it something that happens immediately or directly? Or is it something that happens indirectly? And Hylas agrees, oh, it's got to be only directly. When you're talking about sensible things, they're only the things that you sense in a direct fashion, right? And they go through the example of the book. You read the book, you see the letters. The letters suggest to you ideas of God and virtue and so on. You're reading Thomas Kempis or something like that. You're reading some piece of devotional literature, as Barclay, a bishop, would probably be doing, right? And he says, you see the letters, that's a sensation, but you don't sense God and virtue, right? Those are just sort of abstract concepts. But the letters suggest the words which stand in for those concepts. So really, that which you perceive is that which you perceive immediately or directly. Okay? Well, what do you directly perceive? Well, you perceive ideas in your mind. And so Hylas is sort of stuck. Once he agrees that sensible things are those which are directly perceived, then he can't say he's stuck with the conclusion you can never see a material object. Why? Because what you're perceiving is sense data. And what Locke ends up saying is that you perceive the sense data and then you infer or deduce or reason that there must be something causing it, and that's the material world. And Barclay says, well, why? You know, what's the argument? Give me an argument. All you're saying is like, well, it just kind of seems crazy that there's no stuff behind my ideas. And Barclay says, well, what evidence is there for something beyond your ideas? And you get this discussion of, like, God is sort of the source of everything. And so, and you know, Locke has this idea, well, God created the material world, and that's the thing that gives us ideas. And Barclay has the counter argument, well, just, if you say God's the author of everything, just cut out the middleman and just, you know, God's sending you the ideas. Why bring in this fictitious material world for which there's no empirical evidence? The real world is the world of the senses, the world of appearances. Okay, so what do you think? Does Hylas have a good counter argument, or what might you say if you were kind of had an opportunity to kibitz Hylas and give him some advice on how what he's doing for a comeback in round two? He does come back in round two and ends up pretty much the same place in round one, you know, KO on the floor, right? And of course, there's a reason for this. It's because, you know, who's writing this? Barclay. Who's Barclay's protagonist? Hylas. Who's the antagonist or the villain? Hylas, right? So he's the one that ends up on the losing end of the argument. Any suggestions, or what would you say on behalf of Hylas? What proof is there for a material world? What empirical proof? Yeah.
Couldn't you almost say the ideas themselves are proof that the world is that if you have to directly perceive it through your sense data and it creates the idea in your mind, the idea wouldn't be created without you having perceived it first?
Okay, I just want to repeat this so it's picked up in the recording here. So the idea is that the ideas themselves are proof of a material world because... And what was the reasoning?
Because the ideas are conferred because of your sense data. So your sense, you directly sense something, mm-hmm. and that causes the idea of that object to be inferred. So without having directly sensed it in the beginning, you could not have the idea in the first place.
Well, you're assuming
the idea would suggest that the object existed based on your input data.
Well, it seems like you're assuming that there's a material world out there, and that's what's causing our sensations. But that's what's at issue here. Like, how do you know there's something besides the ideas? Now, why do you say it's a material world which exists apart from God? Why not just why not just say they're coming directly from God? How do you know it's this material world? And what is the material world
anyway?
Because
if you stand in front of a runaway carriage, you're going to get hit by a horse.
But what is a horse? What is a carriage, right? It's just more ideas, right? Sensations of hardness, sensations of, you know, tire tracks after you've been run over, sensations of being hit in the head by a hoof. Yeah.
I'm not following where the God part comes in, because what is God then if everything is just a perception? Like, how do we even perceive God? Give us these ideas.
Well, what Barclay says is that our ideas have to come from somewhere, and where does everything come from? Well, everything comes from God, the source of all.
Well, isn't that the same as, like, saying, well, everything has to come from something, so it comes from these material objects?
But the material objects are this incoherent idea of an unthinking substance. And he says the concept of an unthinking substance or an unperceived object is nonsensical. Because to be is to be perceived. To say something exists means someone is having some set of sensations. Yeah.
Why? That would be my question. Why is God sending us these ideas? What is the point to that?
Human welfare and happiness, putting people through training for heaven. Why does the material world exist, right? If you're going to ask Locke. I think Locke would say the same thing, right? Well, you know, it's sort of God created these beings that he wanted to be happy and serve and worship him, and he set them in the earth and they're put through various trials and tribulations to turn them into perfected saints who are fitted for heaven.
Why is life exist?
Pardon me?
So what is life like not a material thing?
What is life,
you're saying that he's
sending
us just so we can exist, right?
No, we already exist because God created us. But we're mental substances. We're minds. We don't have material bodies. It's all minds and ideas. It is consciousness. Yeah.
Does it have something to do with the fact that we can kind of set up an idea of what the world should react like and then test it against that idea, and that helps to prove Locke's position is that, you know, this must exist because we can think of how it should work and then test it and see that it does work more in the more important side. We can see that it doesn't work as we would see that it would work, because it helps us to see how it's not that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that Barclay would agree that you should do empirical testing when trying to figure out the way the world works. What he would disagree with is the idea that there's a material world. So Barclay did a bunch of work in optics, and he was a scientist. But he said, you know, what is science? So science is just finding the laws of nature which God has set up from the beginning of time that show that which ideas are followed by which other ideas. So he does have this idea of causation. He just says it's cause and effect between ideas, not material substance, which again he thinks is a nonsensical idea. I get somebody else here.
Can I ask a question for what makes God the constant thing in Barclay's argument? Why did he not question God's existence? You know what I mean? Because why was that the given in his whole argument?
I don't understand
the God part. If he's a skeptic on everything else, then why was that the only one thing that he could, you know, deduce that was the reason why all these ideas and thoughts and sensations were coming from?
Is he biased because he was religious? Is that what it was?
Or because religious? You want to avoid, like, the ad hominem argument. Barclay believed in God because he was a bishop, right?
There's no real reason to his, you know, for that to be the one constant thing. He's, with everything else, all his arguments on, you know, the material world and stuff like that, that is something that he believes that there isn't. What makes God the thing that is, you know, constant?
Well, here's what Barclay says. When I try to exert my will to do certain things in the world, and by the world I don't mean this fictitious material world, I mean, you know, the world of sensation, right? The world of real things. Again, what are real things? Real things are sensible objects. The cup. What is the cup? it's a collection of qualities that I sense with my that I sense with my mind. It's not a material object that I can't sense.
But his whole argument is because of God.
Right. So I'm getting to that. So he says, you notice in the world that sometimes when you exert your will, you can do things. Like if I want to wave this pen in the air, I can do it. Right. If on the other hand, if I want to do say 50 push-ups, I could actually do that. But if I tried to do 100 push-ups, I'd probably choke at about 55. Right. And so. I've been working out in the gym, despite appearances. So I could do 50 push-ups, but I couldn't do 100 push-ups, right? So what's going on there? And what Barclay says is that's the consciousness of another will that's contrary to your own, which keeps you from doing the things you want to do. Now, he says the only causation you're aware of in your mind is mental causation, because you have an awareness of your mind of intention. So the only empirically verifiable. This means empirically from the senses, right? Empiricism. Empirically verifiable form of causation is mental causation. Or what he calls will. I have a will. I can make decisions. I can do this. I can do that. I can exert my will. But certain times when I want to get certain forms of sensations, those sensations don't arrive. Now, what Locke, and you might say it like a normal person would say, would be like that you want to do something and the material world's not cooperating. But again, prove the material world with reference to the senses. Can't do it. Oops, sorry, this thing's in the way, it looks like. Put it down without breaking it. But, again, prove there's a material world without reference to the senses. Again, you end up with this sort of occult world, which exists but cannot be seen. Yeah.
Well, how can you know God without
this?
He's not sensible.
Well, he says that you're conscious of God's will when you try to do something and you can't. That's what you're aware of. That's what's pushing up against your will. It's another will. Because this is the same kind of will, right? It's another mind. At least it's something that you're familiar with. You're familiar with the contents of your own mind. You know that you have ideas. You know that you have sensations. And then you know that when you try to do things, something stops you. And you've maybe had the experience of being stopped by like another person from doing something. So what happens when you try to do something and no one else is around, you want to get certain ideas, but you can't. And he would say, well, that's God pushing against you, keeping you from doing what you want to do.
How is that any less nonsensical than real objects?
Real objects are just collections of qualities. What is there to the table other than its shape and its size and its color and its texture, right? You're saying there's a real table apart from all the sensations I have? Where is the empirical proof for that? If you're gonna be an empiricist, knowledge comes to the senses. So how are you going to show? You're going to look at it in a microscope? That's just giving you more shapes and colors and, more of the same, right? The five senses. How can you prove, if you say that knowledge only comes through the five senses, how do you prove there exists a world beyond the five senses? A material world, which is the cause of the five senses. And Barclay says, not only can't you do that, you shouldn't try it because it doesn't exist. It's nonsensical. And if you think about the concept of matter, the concept of unthinking substance again, that he tries to show unthinking or unperceived substance is, and he says it's an incoherent or nonsensical concept. It's nonsensical. Yeah.
So I've got kind of two questions, but we'll go with the first one here. Unthinking or unperceived substance is an inhuman or insensical concept. Like, are we talking about just humanity and not being able to perceive something? Like a different spectrum of light. Does that mean that's a nonsensical thought form? I mean, up until just recently, we weren't able to perceive the electromagnetic spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that it was a nonsensical thought form?
You can have something that you're not perceiving now. That's perfectly fine with Barclay. It's just something that can never be perceived. He says it's nonsensical. The idea that a thing can exist without being perceived by any person.
But I mean, I don't mean to pigeonhole this, but we're talking like person, like as a human being, right?
Not necessarily.
Okay, not necessarily. So like some ethereal being, whatever its form chooses to take, as long as it's perceiving, it can manifest in what we consider to be these ideas, this tangible sense of reality.
You think about what does tangible mean, right? It means that you can touch it, right? And Barclay believes you can touch stuff, right? He says, oh yeah, you pick up a pillow, it feels fluffy, right? Doesn't prove anything about this material world. The idea of a material world is that there's something to the beyond the fluffiness and the smooth texture, that there's some sort of hidden occult real pillow, which is hiding beneath my perceptions, which can never be touched and can never be seen. Yeah.
So going back to his arguments about God for a second, if I was trying to do, like, say, 50 push-ups and I could only do 20, would that be an example of God's will exerting itself upon me, stopping me?
Right, yeah. Uh-huh.
So by that logic, does that mean that if God didn't exist, there would be no limit to the number of push-ups that I could do?
I think he would say that if God didn't exist, then you wouldn't exist, because you would have been created.
Well, it kind of seems like he's just throwing out God's will as like a scapegoat for all of the flaws, like in his philosophy, all the things that don't make sense. God, whenever anything doesn't make sense, someone cries God.
Well, I mean, he might say that's what Locke's doing with the material world. Oh, what's this? Oh, it's the material world. We'll describe the material world. Well, it's like that stuff out there, someplace that's sort of not in your mind. Nobody's ever seen it. Nobody's ever touched it or tasted it. But it's got to be there because it's a deduction of pure reason, like, you know, Descartes, the rationalist.
There would be the other question, like Amy was saying, of why God would care how many push-ups I did at any given time.
Well, why does God care about, you know, you think of any number of things. If you believe the material world hypothesis, right, why does God care how many push-ups you do? I mean, you might be down on the whole idea of God to begin with, but I'm just saying that Barclay is in an especially weak position because he doesn't believe in the material world, vis-a-vis God, because the person that believes in the material world is trying to explain why God doesn't let you do 100 push-ups, material push-ups with material muscles and so on. Why set up the world like that?
I don't want to strain you, sir.
Well, there you go.
God can do.
An infinite
all of
push-ups.
All of them,
yeah.
Yeah. I have a little bit of trouble with that argument. It's not quite making sense to me, because if I can do 50 push-ups in 1 week, then I can do 50 push-ups that very next week. If I continue to do it for fine, then I can do 100 push-ups.
Right.
Does that mean that
you've broken
I can't break God's will, or I can exert my own will to a greater force than God's will is against me?
No, because God set up the laws of nature such that if you go to the gym and you work out those muscles, or you just do one more push-up every day than you did the last day, pretty soon you'll be doing 100 push-ups, and you'll notice like all sorts of different sensations. You'll notice that objects seem lighter. You'll notice that your arms are getting thicker and more defined. All sorts of things will happen. That's just the laws of nature. Why do you have to assume there's a material world hiding beneath your sensations to believe that if you exercise, you get stronger and you can do more push-ups? That's just common sense.
So it's not fatigue that's keeping you from doing the one extra push-up. It's God's will.
Well, it's God's. It's not just.
Is he just considered a sense?
God's not micromanaging the world. God sort of sets up the laws of nature so that when you do certain things, you'll get certain sensations. When you have certain intentions, you'll get certain sensations in response.
But just to kind of piggyback off of that, if you want, like, if you're like, man, I want to do it, but my body just won't let me do it, then what's the argument for that? Because you want to do that one extra one, but your body physically can't.
Well, what does your body physically can't mean? It just means that you get sensations that you don't want.
Right.
Like you form an intention, and your intention is thwarted.
Right.
That's you're getting different ideas than the ones you wanted, different sensations than the one you expected or desired. Well, that's just, you know, that's what, again, the laws of nature, that God has these rules where he says every time you do X, he's going to do Y. He's going to send, you do X, you have form X intention, God will send you, you know, Y sensations.
Okay.
It just operates just like the material world without there being this separate world of objects distinct from your sensations. Yeah.
So would that mean God's will is the laws of nature?
Yeah. Sure. Although not always. Like, God can violate the laws of nature. Like, if he wants Jesus to walk on water, whatever, he can do that. So he's not bound by them. But he set up things so we know what to expect, right? So if I know that if I see a runaway coach, that if I don't dodge out of the way, I'm going to get sensations of pain and, you know, not be able to walk when I want to walk, and you know, I'll walk with a limp for the rest of my life, then I'll jump out of the way of the coach. So it's the same thing with the material world, right? God set up the laws of regularity so you know what causes what. Yeah?
Kind of on that point, you know how Descartes talks about, like, the good sensations are kind of, like, pointing you towards things that are positive for you, like if you're hungry and you eat,
yeah,
you know, like it feels good to eat, you know, like sugar tastes good, it's sweet, so it must be good for you. What, doesn't it, is it kind of contradictive, like, in regard to, like, for example, like, I mean, hard drugs? I mean, yeah, that feels great to your body, but it's also, like, kind of really counterintuitive to, like, a healthy lifestyle. But at the same time, like, exercise can create a sensation of pain, but can also be beneficial in regard to, you know,
Barclay would say some causes happen right afterwards, some causes take longer to take effect. And so sometimes God sends you immediate sensations of pain, like if you stick your hand in the fire. Sometimes God sends you sensations of pain over a long period of time, like, I don't know if you spend too much time on the internet. That you get
so in other words, what you're saying is, like, if you take drugs long enough, at first they feel good, but then ultimately, like, you know, they would beat you down of unhealthy or bad, you know, kill you,
right,
for example. Whereas exercise, on, you know, on the other hand, or university or whatever, would actually hurt at first, but then over a long period of time would actually make you feel good. So he's still kind of right, and I guess that kind of sense, if you think about it that way.
Yeah, way in the back. Out loud, please, too.
I'm just curious about what Barclay would say about things like logical thoughts, conceptions, laws of identity, laws of conservation, laws of freedom.
Yeah, I think you'd all pretty much agree with those things.
He uses very logically, and I understand the chain of logic he uses in his argument for lots of people. Shouldn't there be some kind of abstract argument of abstraction that would try to defeat this? Because, I mean, it seems to me that this is a how can you empirically state that there is there's got to be some kind of abstract concept that says, if everything is these ideas, there's got to be something counterman arguments. And if he says that's true, then what about things that are purely abstract, like abstract ideas about like mythical creatures, or is he saying these things do exist?
Mythical creatures exist? Well, you know, do people really perceive mythical creatures, or do they just sort of, you know, imagine them? I think he would make a distinction between perception and imagination the way Hume does, probably. He doesn't talk much about that, but I think he might be able to say something like, well, you have these sort of vague, sort of hazy ideas that you can, you know, things like dreams and so on, and those those are really just, you know, things that you can cause through your intention. And then there's things which are sort of operate according to these laws of cause and effect, and that those are the real things. And the other ones are the imaginary things. Like your imagination you have complete control over. Whereas in the real world your control isn't as strong. And your perceptions in the real world are a lot more sharp than your the sensations you get when you're imagining something. Yeah.
I keep asking the same question, but I'm not getting it. So what makes God imaginary?
God imaginary?
Because you can't sense him.
You sense him every time you try to do 100 push-ups. Every time you try to jump 10 feet high, that's God pushing you down.
That's going on like faith, isn't it?
How is that different than the material world?
Exactly.
Well, I think Barclay would say... Barclay would say they're not equal because the material world is something that you've never had any experience of. Whereas your mind is something you do have experience of.
But how does that make God? I mean,
the experience of God is an experience of a mind and a will. That's something you have first-hand experience of. Right? In your mind, you made decisions, you have sensations, you're aware of your own consciousness. Go back to Descartes. I think, therefore I am. You have an awareness of your own consciousness. So that's something you're familiar with. So to say that there's a mind greater than your own, which thwarts you sometimes, isn't too much of a leap. But to say there exists something which is not mental in nature, which can't be seen, touched, felt, or smelled or tasted,
is that
there's no reason to suppose that exists at all. There's no possible empirical proof for it. And it's of a totally different kind of thing than the things you're familiar with. Yeah, so he would say, I just put it this way, we know firsthand about mind. From our own case. So that's why mind sort of have a privileged position as an entity. So when you go from my mind to an infinite mind, or at least a very powerful mind, that's okay. When you go from my mind to some kind of hypothetical non-mental stuff, right?
Yeah.
Non-mental stuff, which is totally different from a mind, which can't be seen, which cannot be sensed. Insensible substance. That's what the problem is.
So it's through deduction that they've come up with.
So through Descartes' reasoning, is that, or deduction, is that pretty much what he's basing on why God exists? Or?
Well, he would say, I mean, Barclay would say, you're right that your sensations do have to come from somewhere. And where do they come from? Well, God is the author of all, so therefore he must be the cause. And the God hypothesis has to be going for it because you're still dealing with mental entities. And not this occult substance stuff that Locke's trying to push. Yes?
Wouldn't something like carbon dioxide gas be an example of a non-mental, unperceived, unsensible substance?
Well, there's this little discussion about the air, right? Which is this thing where it's sort of that Locke tries to say, well, what is a sound? A sound is like a disturbance in the air molecules. And Barclay says, well, wait a minute, how do you see the air molecules being disturbed? Can you see the air? And it's like, well, no, you can't really see it, but, you know, and then you...
But you can still feel air if you make a movement with your hand. You can feel the air going past you.
Yeah.
Oxide gas.
Uh-huh.
You can't taste, touch, smell, anything. You don't know that it's there until you begin to black out. You don't understand what's going on. There's no sensory data. It's telling you what is causing this to you. There's a something that's not there that's causing you to stumble around and not feel great. And and you don't understand what that is, because it's literally a god in that it's a non-mental, non-thinking, unsensible thing.
Well, God's not a non-thinking substance, so God's a thinking substance. But on the CO2, Barclay might say
CO.
CO, okay. Carbon dioxide?
Just monoxide.
Oh, monoxide. Sorry, I thought you were saying dioxide.
No.
Okay, carbon monoxide. I think he would say, suppose like you do some chemistry tests, I don't know how you get carbon monoxide to show up in a reaction, but there's got to be some way of I don't know what you mix it with. A chem major can tell you, right? So you take carbon monoxide and maybe you put it into a tube and you put in some other gas and it turns green or whatever like that. Well, does that say, look, carbon dioxide exists? No, it just shows you that that you know when you put these two things together, here's one set of sensations, here's another set of sensations, you put them together and get a third set of sensations. Like every experiment requires what? Observation. How do you observe things? You have to use your senses. What if you're using scientific equipment to enhance your senses? What's a piece of scientific equipment, right? It's all its sense properties. What is there to the X-ray machine beyond its, you know, texture and touch and so on? It's just, you just get more sensations. It's all sensations. What you have to do if you're someone like Hylas, you have to prove there's something beneath the sensations by using your sensations if you're going to be an empiricist. Yeah.
Oh, I was just wondering, what would he say about Alzheimer's? About the loss of actual, like, ideas, or, like, mm-hmm. I guess in a way, knowledge. Like, he no longer recognize a person, no longer remember mm-hmm. to eat, or, like, remember, like, what you need to do in order to eat, or just that kind of a loss.
I mean, about any, like, you know, mental disease, you probably say, well, you know, God set things up so that you have, you know, certain, it's a, again, set of sensations where you have a person can't remember things, and then, like, after they die, you look in their brain, and you see, oh, well, there's some lesions in their brain, or something's kind of different with it, or you have calcified deposits, or whatever you have. And there's this, again, law of nature that whenever you see these certain shapes or colors, or you know, again, long sensible description of what you see when you open a person's skull, that, you know, a habit was happening at the same time that the person couldn't remember things and they were, and so on. And that's the law of nature. But that doesn't show that they have a brain made of material substance which is distinct from their mind or from your mind. It doesn't show an unperceived substance. Because how do you figure out someone has Alzheimer's, right? Well, there's the symptoms, they can't remember stuff, but then to have an actual diagnosis, you have to do an autopsy and look at their brain. How do you determine whether someone has Alzheimer's or not? Well, again, you're using your senses. So back to more sensations. See, just talk briefly about his, you know, Barclay's view, like, as a whole, and you start thinking there's got to be something wrong with it, but you can't quite figure out what it is and what the knockdown, drag out argument is. They'll put Barclay, you know, put Barclay's argument out of its misery. And I think there's a couple of things going on here. One is one interpretation of Barclay is that he's an idealist. Idealism is only the mental exists. And so Barclay, there's two kinds of things. There's minds and ideas. And so you have minds, you have human minds or souls, and then the ideas or states of consciousness they have. And then there's God, who's the infinite mind, who is the source of all the ideas. But really, God's just a special case of a mind. He's a conscious being. And there's no material substance. You don't have material cause and effect, but you have will or mental causation. And then these sort of laws of nature, which are laws of ideas. And so that's the idealist interpretation of Barclay, and I think that's pretty much what Barclay believed. But there's another way of looking at Berkeley where you might reject his metaphysics or a theory about what exists, and you might say, well, that idealism stuff, it's crazy. But some modern philosophers have said that Berkeley hits on something profound in his philosophy of language when he talks about the meanings of words in ordinary language. And that gave birth to the view called phenomenalism. And this is a long
important word.
Right, clearly here. Phenomenalism. And phenomenalism is the idea that words in ordinary language refer to collections of actual and possible sensations. Another way of putting this is that things or objects are permanent possibilities of sensation. Objects are permanent possibilities of sensation. So this is just the idea that, what does it mean when I say I want a drink of water? Does that mean, oh, I could really use 2 atoms of hydrogen and 1 atom of oxygen and a covalent bond? No, it just means I want a clear, colorless liquid that quenches thirst, because I'm thirsty. And so when I'm talking about water, I'm not talking about its scientific properties. I'm not talking about its chemical composition. What I'm talking about is its sensed properties. And, you know, like a person in a pre-scientific culture can talk meaningfully about water, too. He can say, well, I want a drink of water. And again, what's in his mind, it's the same thing that's in my mind. His meaning is the same as my meaning. Water doesn't mean something different to a bushman than it does to a person living in a first world country. Water just means clear, colorless liquid that quenches thirst, not, you know, H2O. And so as a view about, just a view about language and meaning, not metaphysics. And you know, like, put that like that, it seems like a pretty plausible view, and a lot of people that do philosophy of language like this idea of about how language works and what words refer to. Words refer to collections of sense data. They reject the metaphysics, which is that all there is to an object is just the sense data, and we get the sense data from God. But they like this view about philosophy of language. So that's something that maybe you could see as a positive contribution to Berkeley, or of Berkeley to philosophy. Another lesson I think we learned from Berkeley is about the limits of empiricism. If you're going to empiricism, if you're going to be whole hog empiricist and say, I'm not going to believe in anything unless I can see, touch, taste, feel, or smell it, then it's not real, you're going to have with a view like Berkeley's. Or maybe like Hume's. Hume, as we'll see later on, not only jettisons the concept of God, but he gets rid of minds and also cause and effect, and is pretty much left with just ideas. And so if you're going to be an empiricist and be really consistent, you end up with a view like this. And it's really not, unless you go back more towards the rationalist side and have a view like Kant's, that you end up with something that you serve is more in accordance with common sense. So a lot of people think that empiricism is a friend of science, but you know, to believe in the material world, it seems that a thoroughgoing empiricism might not work, because you can't prove the material world unless you have some proof of it outside of the five senses. Comments? Questions? I think there was something else in Barclay. It slipped my mind. I can always talk about it on Monday. So I'll let you guys out of here a little early today. Make sure to post the forums by Sunday night. And I'll see you on Monday, and we'll start right in with David Hume.